Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time listening to the Guelph Politicast, welcome. Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference, or aren't just making life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes. Today I talked to members of the Wellington Water Watchers. The forecast for this Friday, the day this episode comes out, calls for the possibility of a thunderstorm with about 2 millimeters of rain in total, hardly enough to slake the thirst of parched lawns across the city, and one of the many reasons that the other Triple W are trying to draw attention to the issue. Water issues are on tap for this week's Guelph Politicast, but first, my usual public service announcement. Guelph Politico is crowdfunded through Patreon, where you can contribute on a per-monthly basis of any amount you feel comfortable, using PayPal or your credit card. And all that money goes to a locally sourced independent media outlet in Guelph called Guelph Politico. Through your generous donations, you'll be paying to keep the Politicast going, as well as regular coverage of city council and politics in and around and concerning the Royal City. For more details, click on the giant orange P on the right-hand side of the Guelph Politico page, or go to patreon.com/GuelphPolitico. And now on with the show. One look around your neighborhood will tell you that we're in desperate need of some rain. As of the Friday of this podcast release, the city of Guelph has been under level 2 red water use advisory for exactly a month, with water use being restricted to only what's necessary. So here's a question. Would you consider it necessary to take local water resources, fill bottles with them, and ship them off to places hither and yon? That's been a question chased by the Wellington Water Watchers since their inception in 2007. Back then, scarcity had people talking about piping in water to the Royal City from Lake Erie, but conservation efforts by the community at large have been fairly successful in getting Guelphites to think through how much water they need to use on a daily basis. Meanwhile, down the road in Aberfoyle, Nestle is taking 2,500 liters of water per minute and selling it at an incredible markup. The same water that comes out of your tap every day. The present contract between Nestle and the Ministry of the Environment and Climate Change expired last Sunday, but the Aberfoyle plant is still in business, and that makes some members of the Watchers curious. On top of that, as difficult as it is to fight a battle on one front, the Watchers are presently fighting on three, and we talk about those efforts, their accomplishments so far, and how they try to educate people about the paradox of bottled water. I caught up with Robert Case and Arlene Slocum recently in downtown Guelph. So Arlene Slocum and Robert Case, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
For people who may not know your credentials and why you're involved with the water issue, perhaps you can outline your bona fides. Robert, you first.
Well, I live in Guelph.
Yep.
And I use water. I drink water. I think that's all the credentials one needs to be a Wellington Water Watcher.
So you're just a concerned community member.
I'm a concerned community member, yeah. I've been active in the community in different volunteer roles, and I've kind of gravitated towards water and the Wellington Water Watchers over time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm going to say ditto on that one, too. I'm a resident here of this watershed.
Mm-hmm.
And I care deeply about the water that we're drinking and want to make sure that it's there for my children, grandchildren, and further that I can even see. I feel it a duty to safeguard it.
Yeah. And I think that's maybe more a concern more this summer than any other summer because it's been so dry. Also because there's all these various applications coming due for various Nestle facilities. But we'll talk about the drought first. From your point of view, what has been the impact, maybe in terms of awareness about water issues this summer, that, you know, everywhere you go, there's brown grass, there's thirsty plants, you can see, go near a city facility, there's the big red drop that shows we're in, I like to call it red alert phase. Has that helped the cause in terms of raising awareness about water issues?
I would say definitely. You know, we often think that the time and place when people are going to get activated is when their tap runs dry, and their taps haven't run dry, but they're being restricted on what they can do, and that brings a certain level of awareness or at least curiosity about what's going on. It makes our community more open to conversations about why it's so important to safeguard our water. And unfortunately, it takes getting to that point to activate a lot of people, but we're hoping that we can, you know, leverage that so that we don't see, you know, much further in terms of either restrictions or you know, what availability there is of our groundwater. It's so precious, and people feel a deeper relationship to that when there's a drought, I think.
Right. I think it's been actually quite a successful program of the city over the years. I think that's part of why we have sort of a conservation-minded population here, at least to some extent. I think one thing that people maybe are not aware of is that the provincial level permits to take water, like the ones that Nestle have, don't carry with them drought restrictions, mandatory drought restrictions. That's something that the municipalities impose upon us, and we accept them.
Right.
We accept that, you know, during drought, you don't hose down your driveway or wash your car every day. And, you know, but people don't realize that those same kind of prioritization doesn't happen at the provincial level.
Right.
So I think that definitely gives a little bit of an impetus when people learn about that. They're like, what? That doesn't seem fair or right or sustainable.
Right.
But I think there is some potential there for triggering a reaction and getting people looking at the bigger picture.
Wellington Water Watchers has been around for about, it feels like about 10 years, is that right?
Yeah.
Nine and a bit. Yeah.
Nine and a bit,
yeah.
For being accurate.
Yeah.
Has raising awareness, I don't know if you've both been aware, been involved the whole time, but has it been made easier over the last 10 years raising awareness about the needs to protect the water resources? Like, are you finding a more receptive audience? Are you finding more people knowledgeable about the issues than a decade ago?
Mm. Okay, you're going to have to go first, Arlene. Arlene's been involved since the beginning.
Yeah, that's a tricky one to respond to. What we have noticed is that whenever there does seem to be a direct threat, a palpable direct threat to source water, people really come out of the woodwork. And even when we started a little over 9 years ago, one of the major campaigns we were focused on was a Nestle renewal bid back then, and within a short number of months we had, you know, pardon the pun, flooded the Ministry of the Environment with over 8,000 responses on the EBR, which was unprecedented. I think the highest number prior to that was within the realm of a couple hundred responses.
Right.
So people were activated. We were also experiencing a dry summer that summer. But we do find, I would say overall, that there's a certain population that has followed along and kept themselves informed and educated about the importance of source water. But I would say for the most part, unfortunately, in a really busy world, people are very busy, that it takes a crisis to activate people.
Yeah.
And that's a shame.
There's always new people coming into the community from different places and new generations, and so there seems to be kind of a core and maybe a growing core there who have some awareness of what's going on and are probably conserving at where they can at a household level and that sort of thing. I think it's a continual process, so yeah.
Right. I ask because over the last 10 years I read that bottled water as an industry has gone up, you know, from a couple hundred million dollars in profit to billions of dollars in profit. That's just in the last 10 years. So it seems like interest in the product that you guys are by and large trying to fight against has been commensurate with awareness of the issue of them taking the water. In terms of the demand keeps going up and the awareness keeps going up, and I imagine it must be difficult to keep pace when you see those numbers.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of factors involved in those numbers. I think the world market has definitely increased, but I believe, and I don't know the exact numbers on this, but I believe the Ontario sales of bottled water has declined at the same time as the world market's gone up.
Right.
So, and the other piece that I wanted to mention about awareness, that one thing that is interesting in terms of, you know, water conservation and awareness is that Guelph boasts a much better per capita rate of water usage than across Canadian, other comparable cities across Canada. We use much less. So I think the numbers were something like if the average Canadian citizen maybe uses 3.2 liters.
Right.
Per day?
Liters per day. That in Guelph, it's somewhere around 2.5 or 2.6. So,
right.
So there has been some kind of awareness instilled. And I credit a lot of that to an amazing water conservation department we have here in the city of Guelph and their ability to, you know, get the message out and really have people reduce water. I'm not sure that people connect the dots between the water consumption at their home and what might be going on, you know, either in quarrying operations or bottled water operations or anything else that might be impacting source water. I don't think those dots are always connected.
Right.
Yeah, I think sometimes the conservation messages get focused on individual behaviors,
right,
which are important. You know, get a rain barrel so you can water your garden with rainwater. Put the, you know, the aerators on your taps so you're using water more efficiently. So the focus of conservation efforts tends to be that way rather than looking at the bigger industrial users.
Right.
And the groundwater taking involved in the bottled water industry, often the anti-bottled water lobby is focused on the plastic use,
right,
and the trucking and fossil fuels and that sort of thing, which is all, you know, a lot of waste that is generating and important.
Right.
Sometimes they say the fact that they're actually water being extracted from our aquifer here during the time when we are told to reduce our water use, it goes on unrestricted,
right,
or it's restricted by voluntary measures if the water takers choose to. So I think, yeah, it's part of that is making the connections to that water taking activity that's behind the water bottling, and to this idea of, like, it's not just us at the household level that need to restrict. We need restrictions on the bigger and more efficiencies in general.
Right. Well, we've been kind of tap dancing around there, but let's address Nestle directly. One of the reasons we wanted to meet this week is because that permit for the Aberfoyle plant expired on the 31st on Sunday. But I understand, at last you guys checked, they are still in business. They're still
seem to be, yeah,
bottling water.
Yeah.
What do you think? What happens now? I mean, when you kind of think of expiry dates, you know, you might think of your bus pass. You can't use your July bus pass on an August day.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have this company in Aberfoyle whose permit expired on Sunday. Should they be taking water today? And what do you think is going on? That, you know, there's the bottles are still getting filled, the trucks are still being put on the road, the packs are still making it to the grocery store.
What is going on?
Yeah.
It definitely points to a huge lack of transparency on the part of the Ministry of the Environment, who is the governing body who's responsible for issuing and or renewing those permits. And it's particularly frustrating because, you know, many of us have called directly to the ministry over the last little while,
right,
to try to find out, you know, what are the next steps. We assume that they're going to grant an extension to their permit,
right,
and we are frustrated with that because there's been no public process in that. The ministry received Nestle's application for their renewal bid several months ago, and the general process is that they would post, you know, they'd take a few days or maybe even a week or two to review the application, then they would post it to the registry on the EBR, the Environmental Bill of Rights, and allow for a 30-day comment period for people to respond. That's the process that is in place for such permits. Nestle did the appropriate steps and handed their application in. We can't get a direct response from the ministry about why they haven't done the appropriate steps and why there's been no correspondence at all with us, you know, or the general public at all. But Wellington Water Watchers is considered a key stakeholder.
Right.
And we have had no correspondence despite our many attempts to figure out what's going on. So it is a mystery to us, and I believe completely, you know, outside of the realms of perhaps even legality. So I don't know about some fine print in those permits and what they afford and what they offer.
Sure.
I'm trying to learn about that. But
could be, I mean, to me, it's a good question for the Minister of the Environment. And I think people, everyone in Ontario should call the Minister of Environment and say, what is going on? That's a good question to ask the Minister, because the permit's expired.
Yeah.
So,
I wonder if perhaps, because this is such a hot button issue, and thinking too of what happened in Healdsburg, you know, you're talking about Wellington Water Watch is being recognized as a stakeholder. Well, that's a prime example in that whole process. And what happened in Nestle stopping its appeal to keep Healdsburg going. If perhaps there's maybe a bit of political cowardice here that, you know, they're hoping, you know, after the expiry date, you know, perhaps in the middle of August when people are on vacation or, you know, perhaps not worried about water issues as much despite the drought, or at least not watching the news daily, because they're out of town or on vacation or something, if they might just quietly say, okay, here you go.
Yeah, maybe. I think, but I'm not sure if it's so much, I guess it's sort of a political cowardice, but I think what that means is it's incumbent on us to make a stink about it, and to bug our members of provincial parliament and to bug the minister and let them know. I was like, Nestle's not the only one who's make a stink about this. We're out here too, and we want to see some action. I think this is the time for people in this county, in this city, in this province to get active and start using our government representatives and tell them what we want. You know that Nestle is going to push back if the ministry were to try to shut down their operations right now.
Right.
But they got to know that we're pushing back too. And I think that momentum is growing. More and more people who are fed up with this whole, especially with facing climate change and uncertain future about water, it becomes more and more a reality that we got to be really careful about how we use that water in the aquifer. And frivolous uses that generate mostly waste, nothing, no real common good. Those seem to me like the first things that should go. And so I think this is the time for us to tell our government what to do. And that is to honor expiration dates and to consider how to phase out this industry with the next set of permits.
Mm-hmm. I do wonder, because Nestle itself, and I've read this in various articles on the issue, Nestle says that they're allowed to take a certain amount of water per day, which is in the millions of liters.
Yeah.
But Nestle says they rarely take more than 60% of what they're allowed to in a day. And I wonder if, to a lot of people who may be hedging, if like that makes it okay. You know, they take two, not two-thirds, but like three-fifths is what they're allowed. So they're making some effort. It's not the doomsday scenario some of us think it is.
What? I don't really know, but I think once they have the operational so in Aberfoyle, their permit is for up to 3.6 million per day.
Right.
And I think if they were operationally able to actually extract 3.6 million liters per day, they'd be going for a permit of 4.5 million.
Right.
I think it's got to do with operational capacity and having some flex in their permit so that they never max out. I don't think it's got anything to do with conservation. I think it's all operational.
And interestingly, over the past number of years, the amount of water taken that they've had has steadily increased. At the same time, there's been a steady result of a drawdown in the local aquifer system. So there is a correlation, undeniably. And they can go up to that 3.6 million within their full legal parameters.
So they may have built enough buffer for themselves.
I would think so, yeah.
The ministry can draw them down and say, look how reasonable we're being. And
They play that same game in Healdsburg when we're pushing for mandatory restrictions during drought, and they were pushing back saying, no, we're a good corporate citizens. Look, we don't, during drought, our water taking is only 60% of our permit. It's like, yeah, and it's like that all the time because that's what you're operationally able to do.
Right.
It's not, but implying that there's a conservation ethic there is just PR spin.
Yeah. At the same time, I did note in an article from last fall, the chief executive for Nestle says they're always looking for new wells. Like, it's the theory of expansion.
Yeah.
Of
continual growth.
Yeah, continual growth. And of course, that's happening in a lot of places around here because they're looking at one in Aurora and Middlebrook.
Yeah.
And the Allura one's especially dangerous because GRCA is saying that Allura may be a good prospect for drought in the not-too-distant future.
And it's also a good location for a lot of population and industry over the next 20 years.
Right.
It's a place to grow.
Right. That's true, too.
Yeah.
I don't know what the question is here, but in terms of... It just seems so short-sighted to me.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I wonder if we really think through these implications because of jobs. And that seems to be the argument, is that, yeah, the Nestle plant is these really great-paying jobs in a nice place and a company that treats its employees well. It's a Fortune 500 company. That seems like a really hard argument to fight against. Even though the long-term implications is there might be no water to drink. Everyone's sort of thinking of today.
I mean, I do wonder about the trade-off between... I mean, I don't know how they treat their employees, how much they get paid, or even how many employees there are.
Right.
Out in Hillsburg, there's just like a wellhead.
Yeah.
And that's all that it would be in Allura at Middlebrook as well. It would just be a wellhead.
A truck pulls up. They do create jobs that the municipality pays for in repairing the roads and maintaining the infrastructure that Nestle uses for sorting out the garbage that is produced through Nestle products. I'm not sure how it all balances out with the waste element. But then at some point you got to say, you know, the asbestos mining industry, that could get union jobs.
Sure.
Why did we get rid of that?
Yeah.
Some things are just not worth hanging on to. We have to draw the line. And we're saying in Aberfoyle, no to the permit renewal. Let the province come back to the table with Nestle when they have a plan for phasing out over 2 years. Nestle can use their human resources capacity to help their employees move off into new careers and that sort of thing.
Right.
So do it responsibly. Phase it out over the next 2 years. So I don't know that it needs to be that major. Once Nestle's in Allura, then they're going to start talking about the economic benefits that they're providing to Allura.
Right.
And try to create that kind of lock. And so I think it's important that we not go there, because it's a non-starter, really. It's an unsustainable industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not really sure even of the quality or quantity of the jobs that it makes it worth it. I don't think it does.
Yeah.
It reminds me of that conversation that was happening some years ago when, you know, all the awareness was happening around the harmful effects of cigarette smoking.
Right.
Everybody was saying, what about the tobacco farmers, or what about the employees? You know, but there's something that sometimes we have to collectively make a higher decision that's better for us in the long run. And, you know, there are all sorts, I think, with the tobacco farmers, there was retraining on how to switch into other types of agriculture. And, you know, that actually maybe, you know, that infected a huge amount of people. I agree with Rob that I don't think there's actually that many people here that it would have an impact on.
And, it's a pretty automated shop down there.
Yeah.
There is an optics thing, though, that it's, yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing, I do wonder how much people are aware of it. On the Allura issue, I saw the numbers. Basically, if you are someone who lives in Allura, for every 1,000 liters of water you take, it costs you about $2.14. If you are an industrial water user, it is $3.71 for every million liters.
Yeah.
If I'm just me living at my home in Allura, drinking from the tap, showering once a day, doing my laundry, I am paying 600% more for my water, almost 600% more for my water, than if I am putting it in a tanker truck and sending it somewhere to be put in a bottle.
Yeah, I mean, there's nuance there, right? Because it's not really the price of water.
Yeah.
It's a rate charged for accessing the water. So
right.
At a municipality, we're paying to maintain municipal infrastructure.
Yeah.
To keep the water flowing and clean, that sort of thing. Whereas Nestle doesn't have those costs because they create their own infrastructure, so they are charged a fee to recover some of the costs of the permitting system.
Right.
The idea being that water is free and a commons. It should be available to anybody regardless of ability to pay.
Right.
And it should be. But the other side of the commons is it's not a free-for-all.
Right.
The commoners get together and decide who gets access over water. And if someone's abusing the commons, we get to say, no, you can't do that anymore. And so that's, I think, the Nestle thing. It's like, no, that's an abuse of the commons. That's not what it's for. It's not for filling the pockets of shareholders who have a lot of money to start with mostly. Anyway, it's for our local use for social good, and that's where we need to draw the lines. Like, water's a commons, still be free, but those who are not using it for a sort of a life value or something like that, you wait in line or you don't come here at all. I think it needs to be that clear to me.
Yeah, there have been, you know, across the country, other campaigns that have lobbied just for that fee to increase, hoping that that might, I think the idea was that it might impact the business model and crumble the business model, but it's a slippery slope if you start having that argument, because as Rob was saying, it's not, the fees aren't for the water, and we don't want to start making fees for water. We want for the infrastructure and or for the administration. I do agree that the amount that they pay doesn't even come close to covering the administration costs.
Yeah.
And there is I think there's an argument to be said that fee increases to minimally cover the administration costs. But I hesitate to ever link it to actually the cost of water, because then, right, you know, those with the deepest pockets get the water, and we want to revert back to the commons.
You're commodifying water more than you would like at that point.
Yeah.
In terms of the industrial rates, and this kind of does get forgotten, because as much as bottled water has its issues, it has sort of become a straw man for us, because the industrial rates apply to farmers, paper mills, metalworks, these kinds of things. Should those types of businesses that use water for industrial purposes, should they be under more scrutiny, do you think? Or have we gotten too focused on the Nestles of the world?
I think they do, and it goes back to, I mean, the argument that we tried to make in the big Hillsburg appeal that had to do with drought restrictions, but I think we'd all like to apply it more generally to permit big water system, is there needs to be a system of prioritizing permits to take water.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not going to be easy, because there has to be some calculus of economic development and social good and environmental impact and those sorts of things.
Right.
But like the way we do in the municipality, when there's a drought, you can drink water, you can shower and wash your clothes,
right,
but you can't hose down your driveway.
Right.
At the provincial level, if you're taking water to pour back on the ground to grow food that people, especially in the local area, consume, that's one thing. If you're putting it in the back of a tanker truck and driving it out of the watershed, that's a completely other thing. We need to start prioritizing that way.
Right.
I think that's where Nestle becomes like a focal point, because it's like the no-brainer. Like, that's, we're thinking of long-term well-being, managing our water, groundwater systems over the long term. Like, that's the hosing down your driveway of the industrial water takers. Like, that's cutting that one out completely. It makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We often suggest that, you know, that image of that plastic bottle containing, you know, our precious water in it is the poster child for all things that we do incorrectly, both from a permitting perspective and even from a cultural perspective. It's like the sacred essence. It's like put into a plastic bottle and sold. And so we know there's a lot of focus on that, and there's a lot of focus that that's the work that Water Watcher does. And in truth, we do all sorts of other work, but that one is a poster child, and it should be recognized as that. I don't mind the undue amount. I don't think it's undue, the amount of attention that goes to it, because it really epitomizes everything that's wrong with our relationship with water.
Right. Yeah, well put.
Having said that, I do wonder, and I always pose this question when I talk to people about transit issues, in terms of, we recognize the common good of transit, but when it comes to like getting people out of their cars and onto a bus, that is sort of where the rubber hits the road, so to speak, in terms of making that a reality. In terms of the bottled water fight, I think people recognize at least people who are aware of the issues recognize the problems of the bottles, you know, themselves, trucking water, taking water by the millions of liters every day out of the aquifer. But you know what, when you go to the grocery store, it's still $2 for a 24-pack of bottled water, and you see people load up their carts with 8-10 packs of bottled water, and they won't consider drinking out of the tap. How do we battle that perception?
That's an excellent, excellent question. I wish we knew fully the answer to it.
Yeah.
I've been playing around a lot with some storytelling ideas, which is trying to call on, you know, average, let's say average mom, say for example, or we've brainstormed other kind of demographics that are perhaps really large consumers or large purchasers of bottled water, because not because they're bad people, but because right. they're busy and they're inundated with all sorts of information and ads and you know, needs from their family to get their kids safely hydrated. And so, playing with a story that would like call on like their inner hero to pull forward and to like just step beyond the short term and step into something that sees much, much farther. And truthfully, I think that happens through marketing and advertising, and marketers are great at that kind of stuff, and we don't have the budget to do that. But it'd be interesting if we did have a budget to do that, if we could influence that, or if there's other, you know, more on the ground grassroots ways that we could be working with that concept.
It is. I mean, the marketing thing is hard, right? Because we don't have the marketing power that Nestle and the Bottled Water Association has behind them, right? And I do think that that's got something to do with the decline of the formerly ubiquitous public drinking fountain.
Right.
When I was a kid and playing soccer, there'd be like two or three water fountains we all run to, and so people get in the habit of using public water, and it becomes absurd to pay, what is it, 2,000 times more? Even though it's like $2 for a whole pack, that's like $2,000 more, 2,000 times more than what you're paying for it to come out of the tap. And, you know, tap water is more consistently regulated. It's a much actually safer supply. But I don't know how we get beyond that other than just that, you know, on the ground education, PR type of push, trying to raise awareness on that.
Well, I appreciate the candor. but, you know, looking to the future, this is the most valuable resource there is. And we're seeing drought conditions in the southwestern United States, where, you know, even Nestle is trying to get permits in Arizona. Like, I haven't seen rain in 5 years. And, you know, looking at the issues, how dry it's been this summer, talking about climate change, I have to ask, are you guys hopeful about the future and your chances in perfecting the water supply? Or is this a kamikaze mission? Like, is there a dark voice in the back of your mind thinking, like, yeah, I've got to do this, but, you know what, this might still end in 10 years with us trying to figure out where we're going to get our next drink of water?
I think actually we're in a good place long term here in southwestern Ontario. Maybe the best place in the entire world for long term access to water. And the only question is, how are we going to manage it according to what values and what priorities? If we can sort that out, I think, yeah, and I think that's where people are moving. I think people do have this visceral reaction to their thing about why Nestle becomes like the target all the time. Is, first of all, every time you start to relax, they make another investment in a new well or something like that. But also because people have this visceral reaction, it's like there's something wrong about this whole idea of water being relegated to exchange for profit.
Right.
I think people feel that in their bones and they react to it. And I think that groundswell is starting to happen. We're starting to wise up to it. So I do think that the population is starting to grow to it. I'm not sure we're going to shut it all down right now, but who knows? In the short term, I think it's possible. But if we can't figure it out in this part of the world, we're kind of screwed.
Right.
I mean, we have water riches beyond most people's imaginations. But we do need to sort it out. So I would say that in the end, yeah, I am hopeful. I think there's a lot of innovation in terms of policy ideas, social movement, momentum, technology even, that is going to push us eventually in the right direction before it's too late. So I don't know if you share that optimism.
I think one has to be an optimist or try to get up every day and do this kind of work. But I don't want it to be blind either. I feel deeply like I've been really digging in a bit on, and I encourage you to check out the Great Lakes Commons Charter that is trying to reframe the conversation around water to be one, instead of considering it a resource necessarily to be managed, but moving it back into a different kind of language. And even trying to include some of that language in policy, mm-hmm. which regards water in a different capacity than a resource to be managed, that actually references some of the implications that water has for us, because it is different from other things. Without it, we die. We're not alive. And I think that's going to be a long road, but I think that there's some movement around that. And I believe that piece is within each one, like Rob was mentioning, there is sort of a distaste that even, I believe, the people that are buying the cases and putting it in their car, that if you were really to ask them a pointed question about, do you think water is one of those pieces that should be treated as a commodity, they would probably respond no. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's like internalized into us that it's not that it is something much more precious than that. And then I also like to think about, I read that book by Paul Hawkins called Blessed Unrest, where he references these little groundswell organizations that are popping up all over the world to do protection of whatever it is, because it's all related, truthfully. He likens it to the immune system of the planet kicking in, and that it's happening all over the place, and that they're, you know, that gives me hope too, that we're not on our own. There's people all over the place doing work to try to, you know, I think wake us up and invite us to get involved in those parts that are actually necessary for our lives. And yeah, I think that gives me a lot of hope. And I think that when we can and where we can tap into that kind of story piece, we're going to have a lot more success. Then we have to have the information, and we do our best to keep up with the information and educate. But I think the movement happens when we connect in with story and our true connection with something as sacred as water.
Well, I think that's a good place to leave it on, and you guys keep fighting a good fight. Arlene and Robert, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And once again, that was the Wellington Water Watchers and Robert Case and Arlene Slocum, who are members. You can follow the efforts of the Watchers and get involved at WellingtonWaterWatchers, all one word, .ca. You can also engage with them on social media at facebook.com/WellingtonWaterWatchers and on Twitter at WWaterWatchers. Before signing off, I was able to get an answer concerning the question of the Aberfoyle plant's status. I emailed the Ministry of the Environment and Climate Change on Wednesday, and Lindsay Davidson gave me the following statement. Nestle submitted an application to renew its existing permit for the Aberfoyle well. We are currently reviewing the application and supporting documentation. Under the Ontario Water Resources Act, if an application for renewal of an existing permit is made at least 90 days before its expiry, the permit remains in force until the ministry makes a decision on the permit renewal application. The ministry evaluates each proposed water permit application to determine if it meets the principles of the permit to take water program, including protecting the natural functions of the ecosystem, preventing unacceptable interference with other water users, and fair sharing and conservation of water. This application will be posted on the Environmental Registry for public review. All comments received during the comment period will be considered before a decision is made. So there you go, and there you go for this week's Guelph Politicast. The theme music for Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The host of the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes. And while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson. There is also a Guelph Politico Facebook page, which you can find at facebook.com/PoliticoGuelph. And of course, you can donate to Guelph Politico on Patreon at patreon.com/GuelphPolitico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, please consider donating. And as if every week, thank you to everyone who has donated so far. For all the latest political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly, and until then, see you next time.